to have a crack. He is, you know. Oh, I say! Brilliant!
Wonderful run from Giggs! Sensational goal from Ryan Giggs!
Still John Barnes, Collymore closing in!
Welcome to the 90s Football Hall of Fame Show, a podcast brought to you by thefootballfaithful.com. I'm Steve McGovern, and I'll be the skipper for this episode. I'm joined by first-team regular Peter Henry. How are you doing, Peter?
Not too bad.
And returning to the squad today, it's our languid, chain-smoking number 10. It's freelance football writer Stephen Tudor. Stephen, how's it going?
It's going very well, and particularly well after that intro. I love that.
I thought you might. Stephen, by any chance, do you play Fantasy Premier League?
I did for about 3 or 4 years, did awful at it. And then for 2 or 3 years, I started off doing it and then dropped out. So this year, I'm just not bothering.
So you know what? I had a feeling you'd be like one of those people. They'd just be like, no, I don't care. No, I'm done.
Yeah, I mean, it never grabbed me. And there's too many little cheat things. So you put your team together, you know, you make a couple of changes for the weekend, and then suddenly, like, your mate would go, oh, yeah, I've got, like, a couple of hundred more points than you. How come? Oh, well, what I did was you make him a captain on a Friday, and then you make him a captain on a Saturday. It's like, it's a load of the fucking rings. I mean, it's supposed to be just a fun game. So, yeah, I dropped it after that.
Yeah, I think that might be, like, the Sky one. You can, like, make different captains. I never understand. Yeah. I avoid that one. I keep it simple.
It's cheating. That's all it is. Cheating.
Yeah, absolutely. But did you ever play it back in the day with the newspaper?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Oh, really?
The Mirror, I think. Yeah, back in the day, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I bring this up because we have a brand new FPL podcast called The Fantasy Faithful, in which we agonize over our many fantasy regrets and woes, like you would do, Stephen, back when you played. And we try to pick up the pieces ahead of the next game week. So you can all listen to the Fantasy Football in the same feed as this one that you're listening to right now. If you're not subscribed, just search for the Football Faithful podcast online, or simply head to thefootballfaithful.com/podcast. Now,
Did you go for a few Fulham players?
I actually had Mitrovic, and obviously he was dropped.
Right.
So,
yeah.
No, I don't think I will be investing a huge amount in Fulham players this year somehow, but we'll see, you know. Anguissa is back, so, you know.
Yes, yeah.
That's one good player.
Yeah, well, I mean, if he rejuvenates, you know, if he can pick it up again. He was a great player before he went to Fulham, so who knows? Yeah.
And he was a great player when he left Fulham on loan for Real last season, so...
Yeah, there's some kind of pattern there.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a mystery to me. So moving swiftly on, every week we induct a new member into the 90s Football Hall of Fame. And this week's inductee has the proverbial good touch for a big man.
Hazard brings it down. Ferguson shot. What a brilliant goal by Duncan Ferguson. Here's Ferguson! It's Ferguson! It's Krapek! Charles gets the control from Ferguson. Great turn! Oh, what a goal by Duncan Ferguson!
Hitchcliffe's corner.
It's a good one, and it's in!
We are indeed speaking of the artist formerly known as Big Dunk, Duncan Disorderly, Slam Dunk, Duncan Donut, the Dunk Master, but more commonly referred to as Duncan Ferguson. Stephen, I'm going to start with a hard hitter for you. Which is your favourite Duncan Ferguson moniker?
Oh, I love Duncan Disorderly. You've got to love that. It's you've got to love any nickname while... You just know whoever's made it up had a big, broad, proud grin on his face when he made it up. So, yeah, I always go for Big Dunk, but Duncan Disorderly is a firm favourite.
What about you, Peter?
Yeah, it's hard to argue with Duncan Disorderly, isn't it? It's a classic because he literally was Duncan Disorderly.
Yeah, quite a lot of the time. Yeah, it works too well, really. Right, we'll dive into all the goals, the scraps and everything else. But Peter, briefly, what was he like as a player?
An absolute kind of powerhouse of a number nine, a real throwback to kind of early 90s football where you put the ball in the mixer and your front man got up and rose above everyone. He was a massive, like he was a big man. He was well over 6 foot, built of granite. Pure raw aggression in everything he did. Had a great leap that a lot of big strikers don't always have. Great to watch in a way because you knew when the ball went into the box that he was just going to come out of nowhere. They always say goalkeepers take everything, you know, around them out of it when they're coming out for a ball. Big Dunk was like a goalkeeper going for a ball almost. I think a lot of keepers used to stay in their line when they saw him coming. And when he connected with a header, I said it on a previous podcast, seeing a floating ball going into the box and somebody rise above everyone and slam, I'm not saying just head it, but slam a header into the net is one of the most satisfying things you can see. A bit, you remember the Calvert-Lewin goal at the weekend? That was so satisfying to watch. And Big Dunk was the specialist at that. That's what he was as a footballer, but you can't get away from the fact he was one angry, angry man as well. The highlights of his indiscretions on the pitch are probably, you know, just as good. And I'll go as far as to say that they're more entertaining to watch than any goals he scored.
That's an interesting way to put it there, indiscretions. But anyway, he started out his career at Dundee United. And as with all good Scottish players, he moved to one of the Old Firm clubs, joining Rangers in 1993. His record there actually is nothing to write home about. And he was kept out of the team mostly by the free-scoring Mark Hatley, who actually is probably worth an episode of his own sometime. But from there, he went to Everton in the 94-95 season. And the rest is history, really, Stephen.
At Everton, he was home, really. He was loved at Dundee United, scored 28 goals in 77 games there. As you said, he didn't do a great deal at Rangers, but then as soon as he moved to Everton, almost right off the bat. Well, funny enough, I say right off the bat, that's not the case, actually, because he joined with Ian Durant, and Evertonians much preferred the signing of Durant. That's exactly the kind of player they needed at the time, that kind of box-to-box midfielder, a bit of nouse about him. And so Ferguson was almost an afterthought as regards to the two loanees, but as soon as he arrived, they just adored him. I mean, how could you not? Duncan Ferguson is exactly the kind of player who you adore if he plays for your club. He's just this big, monstrous guy up front who imbues every single bit of DNA of that football club into his body and then takes it onto the pitch. So, yeah, they loved him at Everton. I think he's a perfect fit because I really don't want to stereotype Evertonians, but a lot of my best mates are Evertonians. I've got a lot of Blues with mates, and they'd go along with this. They are a very passionate fan base. They are the fan base who will most cheer for a crunching tackle. And so, yeah, they just took to Big Dunk.
Yeah, it wasn't actually straight away either. Like you said, it took a bit of settling in and they weren't sure of him. But I think what kind of cemented his status straight away was actually a Merseyside derby victory over Liverpool, where he just terrified the life out of Liverpool's back four and David James. Because when he went there, Steve, Mike Walker was in charge and he didn't last very long. Duncan wasn't really getting a look in. And then Joe Royal came in and he kind of gave Big Dunk a chance. And the story goes he'd been arrested for drink driving two nights before. He was generally out in the tear in Liverpool. They put him up in like a city centre hotel. Joe Royal threw him in for the Merseyside derby. Everton were scrapping at the bottom of the table and they figured this defeat against Liverpool was going to, you know, send him into no man's land. And second half, Big Dunk just ran amok, got a brilliant header from a corner. And then David James saw him coming in for a ball and dropped it because he was terrified of Big Dunk coming for it. And Everton scored the winner. So that was the game that started, like you said, this two-way love affair between them. And he scored his goals in big games that the fans will always remember, which is always a great trait to have if you want to be someone, a kind of cult hero that he is.
Well, he scored five times, didn't he, against Manchester United, which is a record for an individual player. And then going back to that Merseyside derby, it's often credited that foul by Neil Ruddock really kind of sparked him into action early in the second half. Ruddock tried to basically show him who's boss, and Ferguson responded with just basically losing the plot. But in this instance, kind of channeling it into his football rather than in later times where he didn't.
That'd be a great bare knuckle boxing match, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I hate to watch that.
But you say about the drink driving incident as well. So he was basically not, obviously, 2 nights before, drink driving, arrested. But even the day after, he was drunk. He was drunk 24 hours before a Merseyside derby. Then he scored in the derby. He went out on a piss with the Evertonians, and he was out in a wine bar till like 4 a.m. So, yeah, they loved him.
What was he doing in a wine bar? I can't see Dunk having a Sauvignon Blanc.
Probably the only thing open at that time in the morning.
Might have been the fact that it's 12.5% volume. I don't know. Maybe that's it.
Yeah. He's definitely drinking pints, though. Can we all agree on that?
Yeah, and so, he obviously joins Everton in October 1994, and then they win the FA Cup at the end of that season. And that's, I suppose, Peter, would you say that's the highlight of his career? He didn't win a huge amount of trophies during it. I mean, the only other thing of note in his English football career, anyway, is the FA Cup runners-up medal that he got with Newcastle United.
There's not a whole lot in terms. He doesn't have a very big trophy cabinet. Let's put it that way. A couple of, a Scottish division title with Rangers, and then the Premier League Player of the Month in February 1995. Yeah, we all know, that final. It was Paul Rideout who scored in the final, and then another fellow we've covered on the pod, Daniel Amakachi, is seen as the kind of the hero of the semi final win as well. I do remember him coming on in the 99 FA Cup final, because that's when United won the treble, and I just remember shitting myself for the last few minutes he was on the pitch whenever the ball went into the goal, Peter Schmeichel or not. There was a real feeling of terror whenever it went into the box. I don't think Duncan Ferguson necessarily, a lot of these pods, were always, and it's great to talk about these players from yesteryear and the characters they were, and we like to have a laugh about it. But I don't think either that he necessarily made the best of his talent, because personally, I think he'd a great left foot. He'd a fantastic leap. He'd admit as well, he was wild off the pitch and not just wild on it. And I do think if he had maybe been a bit more professional, I know it was a different time and all, he's definitely not someone that retired and said, I got every bit out of the ability I had. But having said that, he has something that a lot of players that have loads of trophies have. He is absolutely adored by an entire fan base, and he has he's a massive connection. I think we will get on to later. He's still part of the coaching staff there. I think he'll always have a job at Everton. Even if he leaves the coaching staff, he'll be an ambassador or something. And it's quite, maybe it's all the Merseyside derby goals. It's the fact he played with such passion. Like Steve said, he was an embodiment of the fans on the pitch. The goals in big games, although he doesn't have the medals, that connection with a fan base is quite rare,
Is that kind of more important than medals sometimes, Stephen?
Oh, that's a really good question. That's a really difficult question. I guess it's dependent on the individual. You do get these footballers who are almost, robotic in their desire to win silverware. I never get the feeling that was the case with Duncan Ferguson. I think certainly with him, he's someone who cherish the adulation of a fan base over silverware. Going back to what Peter said about kind of not wringing out every last drop of what he could have in his career, 19 years he played for, and he played a lot less than 500 appearances. You can expect a player to, within 10 years, to reach 500 appearances. A lot of it was injuries, but a lot of it was injuries what came about through, as Peter said, kind of a lack of professionalism early on in his career. So there'd definitely be regret at that, because there's no question he had the ability to play, all due respect to Everton, but right at the very top. And if you're going to play right at the very top, then silverware is going to follow. So, I'm sure it's kind of a mixture of both of him. I'm sure there's regret that he could have done more, maybe should have done more. But then, when he comes to work every day at Goodson and he's with his people and they adore him, then, it doesn't get much better than that, does it?
Tony Adams says he's the most difficult opponent he ever came up against. that's saying something, I believe.
Mm.
So then in 1998, he makes the move to Newcastle. And, you know, there's a lot of potential there for, you know, Newcastle, a big club. You know, they were ambitious, but it didn't really go that way, Peter.
No, it was a strange move. Everton needed the money. Newcastle had money to spend and wanted to get a big striker in. They were kind of trying to rebuild after that Kevin Keegan era. You know, Shearer was still there. Rude Hullett was there. And they go out and spend 8.5 million, which it's now my time to say that was a lot of money back then. But it was a big transfer. Like, Everton couldn't turn down that kind of money. But the interesting part is, you know, he wrote a 2-page letter to the Everton fanzine, basically saying, look, I love you. I don't want to go. But, you know, it's in the best interest of the club, blah, blah, blah. And he headed off. Like, we'll get on to it. He spent time in jail in the mid-90s. And when he got back from jail, 11,000 Evertonians showed up to see him in the reserves. And I don't think he ever forgot that kind of thing. But he went to Newcastle and scored a couple of goals on his debut against Crystal Palace. But, you know, playing Rude Hullett was saying he was going to play sexy football. You know, the kind of player Duncan Ferguson wasn't necessary. You know, I don't even really suit it to that style. So didn't have the best spell there. 2 seasons, like you said, lost in the FA Cup final 99, scored 8 goals in 30 Premier League appearances. Once again, you know, 30 games over 2 seasons. It's not a whole lot. A lot of injury problems. Newcastle fans liked him as well. But I think once the chance came back for him to go back to Everton, you know, it always looked inevitable when he left that he wouldn't go to another club after Newcastle. He'd end up going back to Everton. And that's exactly what happened. And they got a great deal. They sold him for 8.5 million, signed him back for 3.75 two seasons later. So that's not bad business at all, you know.
Although I'd say his wages were quite costly. I mean, at Newcastle, there were a couple of highlights. He did score that incredible volley against Man United. But obviously, I think the most notable thing that happened while he was there was Rude Hullett sacking, where Rude Hullett dropped him and Alan Shearer for the derby against Sunderland. And of course, that was Hullett's last game. So yeah, not a huge amount of memorable moments. I don't know if Newcastle fans have a lot to write home about when they think of Duncan Ferguson's spell at the club. Just to go on a bit of a tangent, I'm looking at his Wikipedia page now, and there's a photo of him with, in 1994, sporting the curtains look. And I can't think of another person who the curtains suit less than Duncan Ferguson. Like, it's awful. It doesn't work.
He looks very pleased with it, though, doesn't he?
He looks delighted with life. He's like, this is great. Look at my new haircut, lads.
Just got out of jail.
The line right next to the photo as well, actually, it's just an amazing sentence. Ferguson scored a last-minute winner against Motherwell from a Brian Laudrup assist. And that's just a Brian Laudrup assist in a last-minute winner against Motherwell. It's just in a sentence that you don't expect to read every day. But moving on to more about the type of player he was and what he was like, was he just a lump, Stephen, or was there more to him?
Well, if you allow me a quick digression here, you mentioned Brian Laudrup there. I do some work for a certain company. I won't name them for reasons you'll find out in a sec. So I work for this company and I interview footballers, and our contract's about to end and they want to end on a high, right? And they get in touch and say, we want a legend, you know, to finish off on a high. They turned down Michael Laudrup. I could have interviewed Michael Laudrup this week.
Oh, no.
My all-time footballing hero. I mean, I was gutted. How is he not a legend? But anyway, I digress. Back to Ferguson. Yeah, he was anything but a lump. He was a monster. He was scary. He was formidable. As you both said previously, you know, he's got a great touch as well, but great left foot, good awareness, good movement. Yeah, he was a whole package apart from... he just couldn't stay fit. Okay, of course, his height and physique lent itself to a certain style of play up front. Good, 53% of his goals were from headers. And no one in the Premier League's got a higher percentage of the goals. So, yeah, people played to his strengths. Of course he did. And you know, he put himself about up front and he was a nuisance. But no, he was anything but a lump. He was far more than that. And that's the beauty of him, really. He was that kind of perfect package, which every club that signed him just hoped that he could stay fit, realise his full potential, And then, oh boy, what a player they would have had. Yeah, I loved him myself, and I wasn't, and you know, I'm not an Everton fan. I think a lot of other people, I think a lot of neutrals love Duncan Ferguson.
See, that it wasn't just the injuries. There's also an awful lot of suspensions there.
Yes, yes, yeah.
No, he holds the record with Patrick Vieira for 8 sendings off. That's 24 games. I think there was a few longer than 3-game bans put in there for violent conduct. I'm not 100% sure, but I think there was. And then probably the totting up of yellow cards as well. So he must have been a hard man to manage, because if he could come back from being out for 3 months and get sent off after 3 minutes or 10 minutes, you know what I mean? So, but I do agree. Like, you kind of look at it, you know, he went to Rangers for $4 million in 93, right? That was actually a British transfer record, and just a crazy time, really. It's hard to think now, but at that time, early 90s, Rangers would outspend Man United, Liverpool, Arsenal, whoever. They were the biggest spenders in British football. How things have changed, you know. You were just talking about Loudrup being up there. Gazza was in the same, you know, in and around it as well. So, yeah, I'm digressing now. But so he's the British record transfer at 21, and then that 8.5 million. So, like, you just look at the transfer fees. The managers really wanted him, even though he came with injuries, he came with suspensions, he came with being a bit of a party lifestyle or whatever you want to call it as well. So there was a lot of managers still prepared to, and clubs prepared to pay big money and take a gamble on him, even though he came with, I think the technical term is, a lot of baggage, you know.
If we get to some of his more infamous moments, we'll say his indiscretions, as you might put it. He has a few of them, a couple of noteworthy ones. He once headbutted Jock McStay, possibly the most Scottish name of all time, while he was playing with Rangers. There was also the time he strangled Stefan Freund. And then also he once came on in a match in the 74th minute, and within 10 minutes, he was sent off for an elbow on Herman Hreiðarsson. Stephen, what is your favourite violent flash?
Oh, he's throttled Jason McAteer.
We can all get on board with that.
Yes. My favourite is the way he threw Paul Ince to the ground in one of the derbies. I'm sure it's on YouTube somewhere. They contest the ball fairly, both of them, but they happen to just kind of get wound up amongst themselves, each other, and Ferguson just throws him down like a doll. You have a governor himself, Paul Ince, who just, you know, gets up such perplexed at what's just happened. So that's my favourite. We said at the beginning about, you know, the power in his headers, and, you know, so the muscular headers. And that's what I love about Big Dunk. There was no subtlety to any part of his game. You know, when he headed a ball, he wasn't one for doing like a dainty little flick. You know, he wasn't one for just where it just brushed his kind of fringe and then kind of just took it past the keeper. He powered home headers. And the same goes for his indiscretions, as Peter said earlier. There was no subtlety to them. He, of all his sendings off, there was not one snide challenge. There was not one, you know, stamp on an ankle. There was no rake down calves. There was no pinching. There was none of that business. He just basically headbutted and strangled and threw players to the ground. Now, whether you think that's, you know, right or wrong, that's entirely, you know, down to the individual. But there's something to admire about that, at least. I mean, he did it all in plain sight. And consequently, he was, you know, suffered the consequences every time.
Yeah, it's safe to say if VAR was around now, I think he could have got up to 30 or 40 cents off, probably. But yeah, like, you look back at some of the scraps, and then you even see the fear on other people's faces. Like, he loved a rib punch. I think it might have been Didi Haman for Bolton. I might be wrong. But he definitely hits a... Paul Sharner from Wigan, he hits a rib punch. Textbook. Rib punch. He got banned for quite a while for that one, I think, as well. But you'd have to say, for me, that not my favourite of his indiscretions, but my favourite of his indiscretions that created an image is the Stefan Freund one. The picture of that, where Stefan Freund's neck, he has his hands around it, and you just see the pure, yes, like, Big Dunk is basically ready to strangle the life out of him. That photo is one of the most iconic in Premier League history, as far as I'm concerned. It's just, not that I'm condoning that kind of violence, but it can't deny it. It's a great photo. Like,
well, you say about being fearful of, kind of, you know, players being fearful of him, and that extends to his teammates as well. Have you heard the story about Pistone at Newcastle?
No.
Pistone, basically, during a game, I don't know if a pass went awry or something, but he told Ferguson to fuck off. And the whole team was like, oh my God, what have you done? So Ferguson stared him out. During the rest of the first half, Bastoni was trying to kind of have a bit of chatter with him, and, you know, basically trying to creep around him. Ferguson wasn't having any of it. At half time, or it might have been after the game, Ferguson was standing there again. He hasn't said a word at this point, just staring at Bastoni. Bastoni starts crying, actually starts crying in front of all his teammates. That's impressive.
Oh God,
did he get him out of it, getting a baiting then, or
it worked? It got him out of the place. I think Ferguson then said something, you know, very kind of generic, like "Don't ever do that again," or "Don't ever say that to me again." But you know, by which time his teammate was in floods of tears.
Yeah, I was watching a clip last night, and him and Yap Stam have a bit of a wrestling match.
Oh, that would be good.
The ball's going down. And it's fair, but Dunk is getting really aggressive. But Big Yap was a big man as well.
Yeah.
And Mark Bosnich comes running out to kind of get the ball. And Big Dunk goes to tackle him, even though the ref has done it. You just see Bosnich put his hands up in the air and freeze. It's like, no, I don't want any part of this at all. I was looking through his goals as well. There's one against Middlesbrough where I think it's Colin Cooper that used to play for Middlesbrough at centre-back. And the ball comes to him about 30 yards out and he shanks his clearance. It goes way, way up in the air in towards the goal. So it actually lands about, say, 8 to 10 foot away from the goal. But Dunk goes flying in after it. And any other goalkeeper, the goalkeeper stays on his line. I think normally a goalkeeper comes out with his knees up like goalkeepers do. And like they take the man out of it and punch it away. Goalkeeper stays home. Dunk just slides in and volleys it into the net. So there was fear in that goalkeeper, I think. You couldn't help but be afraid of him. He wasn't just big, and it was the aggression. It was the look on his face, I think, that just scared the life out of people, and rightly so.
I think a lot of times in football as well, people, particularly people like Paul Ince, who I mentioned earlier, there's certain guys who go around pretending to be the hard man, acting the hard man, and they'll square up to each other, but they're perfectly aware at all times that if he raises their arms, they're going to get sent off. So they're basically, it's like a pantomime. Yeah. With him, it was entirely real. He was willing and able to kind of put out violence on a whim. You know, at any given time, he was up for it, basically, and a lot of players aren't. I mean, you mentioned there about a stair. Can you imagine what the burglars must have felt like realising they broke into his house? On two occasions, you know, he kind of battered burglars who broke in and took them down. And this is a guy who went to, you know, a tough prison at a young age, 44 days in HMF Barlinnie. And coming out of that, like I say, he's, in terms of the hard man, however much, you know, you want to kind of glorify or condemn the hard man in football, he was a hard man.
Yeah, I agree. There's no acting with Big Dunk. A lot of other people posture. You even have that, like, you know, mates who kind of square up because they have other people behind them. But they're never actually going to fight. Yeah, someday they're going to walk up to someone like Big Dunk and regret it.
We should also mention, of course, in 2004, he was actually accused of racial abuse by Lewis Boa Morte during an FA Cup fourth round match. Now, the accusation was dismissed by the Football Association because there was insufficient evidence, basically. But I think it's worth mentioning because obviously we're making a lot of jokes and stuff and having a laugh about all these kind of things. But of course, there's a lot of seriousness here as well, you know, at the end of the day. You mentioned the burglary attempts, Stephen, in two different places. Well, one was in Lancashire and one was in Merseyside. And like you said, you could just only imagine what they must have felt when they realized who they were robbing. But he also has four convictions for assault, two from taxi rank scuffles. Maybe he just shouldn't get a taxi anymore. One was an altercation with a fisherman.
He might have met his pub. Match. Them fishermen are tough.
Well, that's the thing. Maybe that's what he wanted. He wanted, you know, I need somebody who is on my level, you know? And then one of them was for his, was actually for the headbutt on John McStay, which is a kind of rare enough in itself. You don't see incidents on the field result in a conviction. And the first incident, actually, one of the ones at a taxi rank, he headbutted a policeman.
Yeah, so he got a expect prison time for that. Yeah. But you know, so that's the thing. People do forget that there's two ways of looking at it. Both are quite kind of relevant, I guess, as regards to him getting sent down. On the one hand, no other footballer before or since has this happened to. You know, have they served any jail time for kind of on pitch kind of violence? But This was, as you say, his fourth conviction. This was for an accumulation of instances. And so when you headbutt a policeman and then you go on to assault someone else and you assault someone else and then you assault someone for the fourth time, irrespective of whether it's on a football pitch or not, it's still, you know, a human being you're headbutting there. So you're going to get set down. So, but Ferguson, he took that to heart. He never played for Scotland again, refused to play international football again. And he carries that grievance to this day. And you can say, okay, yeah, I can see that, because you look at some of the actions of other footballers who, you know, escaped jail time. Just a one little note on that, by the way. Wayne Rooney used to send him letters when he was in prison. I think Rooney was only about kind of 10 or 11 at the time, but obviously an Everton fan, and he used to send him letters.
Yeah, I remember hearing about that. That's kind of cool. Just to go on those incidents, the first one, like I said, for the headbutt and the policeman, ended up in a £125 fine. The second, he got a £200 fine for punching and kicking a supporter on crutches. On the
third, I didn't mean to laugh at that.
On the third offence, he was sentenced to a year's probation. So he's like three strikes and he's still only getting a year's probation.
Yeah.
And then obviously for the headbutt on John McStay, he finally served a 3-month jail time, which is also kind of like, it's like four times he's been done for this and he only gets 3 months. It's actually quite incredible.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's the fact that it was because of something that happened on a football pitch that was the shocking part of it. But like you said, when you thought everything up, you would think he would have got 3 years for headbutting a policeman, to be honest with you.
Mm.
That's a strange one that he didn't get much of a fine there. I think a lot of the furore at the time, because it was a big deal, people were saying, is this a precedent? Like, because, you know, if you break somebody's leg on a pitch, can you go to jail kind of thing? But like Steve said, it's never actually happened since. Because you could argue that, you know, standing up and having a fight with someone, I would personally, I don't think any of it's right, but I would personally say someone who swings a punch or a headbutt with someone they're having a fight with is less deserving of punishment than somebody intentionally breaking another professional footballer's leg.
Post-football, he had a brief stint actually as Everton caretaker manager there last season before Carlo Ancelotti came in. And I always love in England how they just refer to them as caretakers. So I just imagine them in overalls and holding a broom. But he was in charge for 4 games. He was unbeaten and had a 25% win rate, which is impressive in its own way, to like not lose a game, but also not win very many.
Serious run of fixtures he had though, Steve. It was like Arsenal, yeah. I think it was
Man United was the first one or something.
Man United,
Chelsea,
Arsenal, something like that. Yeah, no, it was actually really. It was actually a pretty impressive when you see the teams.
Yeah, not bad going, absolutely. But of course, and he's still there today. He's actually Carlo Ancelotti's assistant, which is again not something we could have predicted even in this weirdest of years. But to wrap up, Stephen, he seems to me like the prime example of a player who becomes inextricably linked with one club, and he's someone who is not only defined by the club himself, but actually in a way he helps to define the club in their own small way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think very much he is. It's a perfect marriage, Everton and Duncan Ferguson, both in the playing days, but also the character that he's shown subsequently. So you mentioned there about his interim manager spell. I've written an article for the site on Duncan, and I've included some of his programme notes in there for his first game. Really inspiring stuff, really passionate stuff. I mean, you know, he doesn't hold back. He says in those programme notes that being Everton manager has made him the proudest man in the world. And fans obviously respond to that. And you also hear the stories as well about how much he does for charity, how much he does for the community, and how even as a player as well, how often he used to visit the local hospitals and just kind of leave huge donations and kind of insist upon anonymity. But, you know, inevitably, word always gets out about that. Or it takes a nurse to pass it on to a friend in the pub and so on and so forth. So Merseyside knows what kind of man Duncan Ferguson really is. You know, of course we're going to look at his playing career today, and of course we're going to look at, you know, his sendings off and the kind of powerful physical player that he was. But the man off the pitch these days, having matured now, you know, he's a diamond by all accounts, and Evertonians adore him, as we said at the start, and I think they'll always adore him.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful way to round things off. Duncan Ferguson, Duncan Disorderly, as he will now forever be known, is the latest entrant into the 90s Football Hall of Fame. Up next, we've got a quiz. This quiz is brought to you by Football Index. You can get a £20 bonus when you sign up for a new account. Just use the offer code FF20. Now, lads, the rules are very simple. I'll ask a question. You say your name to buzz in, and then you got 10 seconds to give an answer. The best out of five is the winner. This is not multiple choice, by the way, just to let you know. Are we ready to go?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Question one. Phil Babb played for Liverpool between 1994 and 2000. For which European club did he leave Anfield?
I know who he went from.
No.
Foggy.
Can I guess, Stephen?
You can guess, yeah.
It's a real guess. Perugia?
No, it's not Perugia. I'll give you both a hint. It was a club in Portugal.
Peter. Oh.
Go ahead, Peter.
Sporting Lisbon.
Oh, the correct answer is actually Sporting Clube de Portugal. No, I'll give that to you. Yeah, it was Sporting. So that makes it 1-0, Peter. Question two. Which goalkeeper was voted into the PFA Team of the Year in the 1991-92 season?
Stephen, is it too early for Schmeichel? Peter Schmeichel.
It is too early.
Yeah, it's about 3 years too early, isn't it?
Go ahead, Peter.
I might be a bit early for him too. I'm going to go Nigel Martin.
Incorrect. I'll give you both another guess because I don't want to have to go to a tiebreaker. So,
I'll guess it. Bosnich at Villa.
Incorrect. Peter, do you have another guess?
Safe hands, David Seaman.
No. Stephen, you're actually going to kill yourself. You're going to kill yourself. That was way too much. Jesus Christ. You're going to kick yourself when you hear it was Tony Cotton.
Really? Oh, yeah. He's one of my favourites. I'll tell you what. Tony Cotton and Duncan Ferguson in a fight. Now that I would pay to see.
Let's get it on pay-per-view.
Yes. Go. Yeah, for charity. It should do, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Question three. When Duncan Ferguson scored that volley against Man United for Newcastle in 2000, who was the Man United goalkeeper?
Can I have a season again?
Peter.
Yeah, go ahead, Peter.
Mark Bosnich.
Mark Bosnich is correct. It was the 99-2000 season, Stephen, unfortunately. Right, question four. In 1993, Brian Clough managed his last game of football. Against which team were his Notts Forest side facing?
Ooh, that's well hard, mate. All right, Stephen, I'd guess it's Sunderland.
It is not Sunderland. Peter, do you have an answer?
No, Sunderland weren't even in the league, were they? I'll go with Liverpool.
It was Sheffield United. That was his last game. Notts Forest got relegated after losing. And he never managed a game again. It's 2-0, Peter, but I might as well go with the last question anyway. Liverpool beat Sunderland 2-0 in the 1992 FA Cup final. Who scored the second goal that day?
Stephen.
Go ahead.
I think he scored the first, but I'm going to say Michael Thomas.
He did score the first.
Oh, no. Well, I think I know who scored the second.
Peter, do you have an answer?
Ian Rush
is correct. It's 3-0.
A battering. Fair dues. Oh. I feel like Stefan Freund.
You had some good guesses. You know, the effort was there. The intent was there.
That's going to be on my gravestone, by the way. The effort was there.
He tried, the lad.
He did.
Right, so Peter wins this week's quiz. That's the end of this episode. If you enjoyed our show, then please take a moment to give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Our regular pod is also back, where we review the week in Premier League action. So make sure to check that out, as well as our new FPL show, The Fantasy Faithful. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at @FootyFaithful_ for more football content. Stephen, thanks a million for joining us. Is there anything you'd like to plug?
No, I can be found on Twitter, SteveTudor123, and I tend to get abusive when City lose.
Oh, good to know. But, Grant, and people obviously will be able to read your Duncan Ferguson piece on footballfaithful.com at the minute. Thanks a million.
Pleasure, mate, always.
Thank you, Peter.
Cheers, lad.
Thank you for listening.
I love the place, and it means everything to me to be a part of the club and to be a part of the fans, and that feeling on a Saturday when, you come out here and we're all in the stadium wanting the Blues to win. It's a tremendous... tremendous, a lot of power there and energy, and it's just, I feel a part of the Everton family and I feel a part of the fans, and of course when we're celebrating that win, you know, there's nothing better. It's been a massive part of my life.